It has been a joy to be with you this weekend. I apologize for the fact that I have spoken so long on several occasions. I will tell you, it is not my custom. For those of you who have heard me otherwise, you'll be aware that that is not my usual custom. However, this topic is something that brings out the worst in me, because these subjects are subjects that I am intrigued with, that I am deeply interested in, and down through the years, I have known so many young people who have been lost to the faith because of the very kinds of questions that we're talking about here, both this evening and throughout the week. When I grew up, I had a good friend in the congregation that I worked with and worshiped with. I was a young fellow in high school and college, and he and I went to high school together. And I remember the first year of college, I took many of the same courses he did. I was a science major at the time. We were at Wayne State University together, taking many of the same courses. And I remember at the end of the first year, his mother said to him, and this is a boy that I had stood with at the Lord's table, and we had waited on the table together, and he was a Christian, and I was a Christian, and his mother asked him one night, said, "What are you looking for?" He was in the kitchen searching for something or other and going through the cabinets. And he looked at her and he said, "I'm looking for God." This loving mother who had raised him, made so many sacrifices for him, he was throwing God in her face because of the ungodly instruction he had been getting from some of the same professors I'd been living and listening to through that period of time. And I saw the loss of that man. He left the church. Obviously, he left the church and never has come back. Now, through the years, I saw him a few years back, and his life is a wreck. He's been divorced. He's had all sorts of different problems in his life. And I'm not really all that surprised at all that. But the point is that these are very near and dear to my heart, these subjects are. Now, tonight, we're not going to really talk about what we'd call textual criticism, even though that says what it does up there. Textual criticism is actually the technical term for an approach to this whole matter, and the title is The Reliability and Integrity of the Book of Books, the Bible. And textual criticism is a method that deals with the subject we're talking about. Do modern Bibles reflect what the ancient authors really wrote? And I want to begin with a voice of a religious cynic. Now, this is Dr. C.A. Briggs. It would not be strange for you to go to a college or university campus and listen to a professor who would express something of this kind. Even today, or probably not on a Sunday, but on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday of the week. And they would say something like that: "We will never be able to attain the sacred writings as they gladden the eyes of those who first saw them and rejoice the hearts of those who first heard them. If the external words of the original were inspired, it does not profit us. We are cut off from them forever. Interposed between us and them is the tradition of centuries and even of millenniums. The point is, the original authors, they wrote what we call the autographs of the Bible. Let's just say Moses sat down and he wrote the book of Numbers one day. And we pick up and we open the book of Numbers, and what Briggs is saying is we don't have it. What we have is something that has been greatly changed over the course of many centuries. And so they gladden the eyes of those who first read them, but since then, the millennia have interposed themselves, and as a result of this, you can't believe it anymore, because it's not what Moses wrote. I'm here to deal with that tonight. I'm here to deal with that. That's what we're going to talk about. But I will say to you, there are other voices that say just the opposite. The voice of faith says, quite distinct from the inspiration of the original manuscripts, have been the care and the providence whereby the scriptures have been kept pure. I want to think with you for a moment about the creation. My Bible says that my God made the heavens and the earth. We sometimes think that the heavens and the earth are kept together and they are maintained just by material or natural laws that God created at the origin of the universe. And to some extent, that is true. However, the Bible says that God maintains it providentially, and that he is anywhere and everywhere within that universe. And he is assuring the care and the protection of God's people. Now, if that is true, and I believe it is it not also true that God, who originally assigned these men this task of writing down these books, could have, by his providence and by his care, this omniscient God, this omnipotent God that we believe in, does he not have the power to bring it down to me, to my time, so that my eyes can rejoice in what it says? And so Dr. J.H. Skilton, just as much a PhD as Dr. Briggs, said it is by virtue of these two separate considerations, the immediate inspiration of the sacred writings in their original form and the singular divine care and providence, that the Old Testament in Hebrew and the New Testament in Greek are to be regarded as authentic. How reliable. Let's start with the Old Testament. We're going to deal with the Old Testament and then with the New. In Washington, D.C., you can visit the Archives Building. Maybe you have. I have. Where the original Declaration of Independence lies preserved under glass. You can still see there the signatures of John Hancock. You can't miss it. That's a big signature. John Hancock wanted to make sure his name was seen. He was a bold fellow. He was a fellow, however, who was marked for death when he signed that. And the fact that he signed it so boldly says something about the man. Anyway, the point is, what about that? Frankly, it has no real value. It has, of course, historic value. It has antiquity value. Because even if it did not exist, there are many, very many accurate copies. So it continues to exist in that form, even if it did not in the original. But of course it does in the original. We no longer have the original documents that were written by Moses, Isaiah, Ezra, or any of the other of the Old Testament worthies. All the originals were destroyed by the ravages of time. Someone says, well, then we have no way to check it. We just can't check it. Yes, we can. I'm going to show you how over the course of this time we have together. But I want you to understand something just as a preliminary. God knew what he was doing. God always knows what he's doing. Why were all the originals, the autographs, why were they destroyed by the ravages of time? Why did God permit that to happen? Let's put it this way. If we had the originals, like let's say we have the original Declaration of Independence, unless it was under glass, which that would have been quite impossible for many millennia, the result would be that somebody could have changed that one original, and we would never be able, especially if the fellow was very good at it, we would never be able to detect the change that had been taken. And so there is an aspect of the wisdom of God even in that. We have copies. Let me tell you, we have thousands of copies. How good are our copies? Natural question. How close to the originals that were written under supervision of the Holy Spirit were they? Well, this brings in the words textual criticism. Textual criticism studies the reliability of the text. It's not that that the textual critic is critical of the text. What he's trying to do, he's trying to create a critical text, a text that is an amalgam of all of these many manuscripts that have been discovered down through the years, in order to get as close as possible to the original autographs. It investigates the methods of ancient scribes and their copying manuscripts, and that is a technical process. It requires that we put ourselves, in a sense, in the shoes and in the mindset of an ancient scribe and see how he worked, the kinds of mistakes he might conceivably make, the kinds of corrections he might conceivably make. And over the course of time, tonight I'm going to show you some of those mistakes, how they were made, and how that process took place, and how they were fixed. To really study it, that is to say, if you really say, I want to become a textual critic, you would have to be knowledgeable in both the languages of Hebrew and Greek, and perhaps in others, a number of different languages like Latin and Ethiopic, and just a whole host of others. For 2,000 years, the Hebrew language was written with virtually no vowels or word dividers. Now, somebody said, how in the world did they talk to each other? Well, it's not the talking that was a problem. It was the writing that was a problem. Today, for example, if you learn Arabic, it's the same way. If you learn modern Hebrew, it's the same way now. But modern Hebrew is not the same as ancient Hebrew. They're very different languages. So learning ancient Hebrew would not make you very conversant with the Hebrew of the Old Testament. Now, you would know a lot of words, but then some of the words would have some really strange meanings. Like the word for chariot is the word for a tank today, you know. That same word is used in the ancient Old Testament to describe a chariot, but today it's a tank that shoots big shells, you know, that sort of thing. Well, again, for 2,000 years, the language was written with virtually no vowels or any word dividers, so that the letters were just all run together. And I'll show you that in just a minute. The letters BD, for example, in an English sentence would be bad, bid, bed, bud, bade, and bide. All of those, or any of those, and it'd be kind of hard to discern the difference between them. The consonants katav, kaf, tav, and bet in Hebrew would have meant, if you just saw them in a line of writing, it would mean to write, it could mean he wrote, it could mean writing, or it could mean something that is written. Any of those meanings were available. As a potential, the context would tell you. It was not as much a problem as that would be in English, however, because that's the way they thought, and they understood the language, the way it worked. They were more conversant with that, just as the Arabs are today with Arabic. Arabic does exactly the same thing, even to our day. But it did cause some problems. The Old Testament text had a long tradition of what we call vocalization. In other words, people read it aloud in the synagogues. They read it aloud in their personal studies. And that's the way study was done, by the way, in the ancient Testament. The Bible uses a Hebrew word that means to mumble when one is reading and studying. One mumbles to himself. You ever heard someone study in a sort of a mumbling fashion? Well, that's the way people read, and they still do that today. If you get very close to someone who is doing this with their Bible and their Torah in front of them, then if you get very close, you can hear them. They're mumbling aloud the words that they are reading. And the Old Testament had a long tradition of such vocalization that made the process somewhat easier. Now, this is illustrated, I believe, well, in something we looked at not long ago, the Moabite stone. This is the Mesha Stela, it's called, from the year 853 BC or so. And note, if you will, that the letters, if you look carefully, All the letters are just one right after another, aren't they? Just one right after another. Just run together. There's no spaces. It'd be nice if they had spaces, but they don't have spaces. And that suggests to us that Moabite was just like Hebrew, and pretty much they're the same language. They have little differences, but essentially they are both what we call Semitic languages, so they're a member of that family of cognate languages called the West Semitic languages. Well, the Hebrew language, in the Middle Ages, scribes finally invented a system of dots and dashes to indicate the vowels scientifically. They were called vowel points in art of this day. And Hebrew then went through three stages of that. The first stage, in Moses' time, there were no vowels at all that were written, only the consonants, as we just said. And the second stage would have come about the time of Ezra the scribe, who is a very prominent figure in the language and in the literature of the Bible. A few vowel letters were used in the text for a change to indicate their sounds. Vowel letters like yod or vav or wow, as some people say, or the h, which sounded but that meant it was a feminine vowel. In other words, a woman's name might have on the end of it. And so these letters were finally put in, and that made a big difference. The third stage was what is called the pointed text that did not appear until the Middle Ages. Now, this is important in the dating of a piece of literature. If you discover it, you know the relative time period it falls into on account of these letters, whether they're found in the text or no. Now here's stage three. This is a beautiful Hebrew manuscript right here. And if you'll notice, this says, and of course I'm not saying you know what it says, but what I'm saying is this little key, this little dot under there means key. And this one here means A, and that one means le, and that one means ha. So you would pronounce that ki elecha. I know that's exciting, but the point is that's how it works. That's exactly how the Hebrew language works and Semitic languages in general. This is a beautiful text. It's what we call a Masoretic text, and it's from the end of that period of time that we were talking about, the Middle Ages and onward. Now, each of these had a meaning, and it's not important to think in terms of that, but the point is that this is that system that they essentially worked out. Now, the manuscripts themselves, textual criticism must deal chiefly with that consonantal text, since all the vowels were added later, weren't they? Those dots and dashes that say ah and e and eh and a, they came later. So they're not particularly important, although they do help us because they tell us about that vocalization tradition. Well, textual criticism often has to ignore word division since it came later. That's a fairly important thing. In certain strategic instances, how you divide the consonants makes a difference in how you read the text. And so how close is the consonantal text to the original? That's our real question then. Well, the question is, how carefully has the copying been done down through the ages? The manuscripts in the museums answer this question for us. They're found in museums all over the world. I'm going to show you a few of them. But here we do run into a serious problem. Until recently, there were relatively few old Hebrew manuscripts in the museums. The Jews, the problem is, this is what we sometimes wonder, what were they thinking when they did this? But the Jews of the Middle Ages reverently destroyed, they took out and they buried their worn out copies of the scriptures. And when we think about that, it makes us sick to our stomach. But the point is, they wanted the Word of God to be handled in an appropriate fashion. And if they were to take it out and just throw it somewhere, and someone, a pagan, came along and did something to it, they would dishonor it. And so they did not want it to be handled by unclean hands. And so they would bury it protectively. But with that, of course, they destroyed unbelievable numbers of amazingly priceless manuscripts. Fortunately, before they threw one away, when it was worn out, they prepared a new copy and sometimes several new copies from it with utmost care. The Cairo Geniza manuscript and the manuscripts that were found in that Geniza, the Hebrew word Geniza means a hidden place, a place of hiding. And the Cairo Geniza manuscripts represent the 10th to the 13th century cache of 210,000 fragmentary Hebrew texts that were discovered by Dr. Solomon Schechter in the year 1897. It was found in this Ben Ezra synagogue in Cairo, Egypt, and up here in this area, in the loft area, is the Geniza, where the manuscripts were hidden. And so eventually it was discovered and these were made available. What happened? They put them up there and apparently they forgot they were there for centuries. And thank you, Lord, that they did. This is God's providence. Because what this has allowed us to do is get some idea what the stage of the text was at that day. You'll note that there are no dots or any dashes or anything like this. This is just the Hebrew text, plain and simple. Goes back very, very early in that process. The copying of a scroll, if they made too many mistakes, and sometimes, you know, scribes are just like everybody else. Some were good, some were bad, some were hardworking, and some were lazy. And the lazy and the bad ones, I don't know, maybe some of them didn't see too well. I can appreciate that. I wore thick glasses most of my life, and so I can appreciate what their problem was. But they branded the copy unfit for official use if it was bad. Now, how did they do that? Well, they had the most interesting process. They counted all the words and all the verses of every book of the Bible. And they calculated, and this is what they call the Masora Parva, and that they would annotate exactly where the middle verse was in every book of the Bible so that they could count backward from that verse and forward from that verse, and it ought to be exactly what they expect, as the annotations say. But more than that, they also counted the middle word of the whole book. And they would count all the words before it and all the words after it. More than that, they counted all the letters of the book. Counted all the letters before and all the letters afterward. And then they knew where they stood. Is it the right number of numbers? The Masora Parva told them. And so they knew. If there was a problem, they had to fix it. They had to find the problem and fix it. Such care, ladies and gentlemen, is unprecedented in the history and preservation of ancient writings. Plato, Aristotle, Horace, none of them were preserved with such care. Yet none would argue that we do not have their very words. I've never heard a scholar say, we don't have the words of Horace, or we don't have the words of Plato, or any of the rest. But they did make mistakes. What kind of mistakes did they make? Well, we understand the kinds that they made. They're the same that we make today, especially when we write by hand. The failure to repeat a letter or a word, we see it once and then we go back and when it ought to be repeated, we leave it out. They repeat what occurs only once. Sometimes they have a false recollection of a similar passage. Sometimes they would do that, let's say, from Luke to Matthew. They thought, well, they would start citing a passage and they would start working from memory. You ever do that? If you know the Bible really, really well, you'll have a tendency to do that. But sometimes your memory doesn't work as well as you thought it would, and you're citing Matthew when it's Luke you're working with, you see. And so that kind of mistake frequently occurs in the scribal work that they did. Omission of a passage between identical words. You ever look up as you're copying something onto a sheet? And I'll do this often. I catch myself as I'm citing somebody and quoting a statement someone makes. I look down and I get to the word and I'm writing over here, and I look back and I catch an and, but it's the wrong and. It's an and two lines down. And what I've done is I've skipped everything between. But then when I proof it and correct it, I read it and I say, that don't make any sense. What happened there? I go back to my citation. Well, they did the same thing. They did exactly the same. And so that kind of omission would occur. Confusion of letters that look alike. There are many letters in the Hebrew language. For example, you could take the yod. If you made the yod large enough and a lamed small enough, they look very much the same. And frankly, if some people, when they write, do that. Have you ever looked at somebody's writing? I'm talking about cursive writing. When people are writing cursively, especially, it's not even in school. They hardly teach it anymore. But cursive writing, very often, you'll look at it and say, what is it? Is that a U or is that an I and the end of an N? What is that? You know, we see that too. And we have those kinds of problems, do we not? And so confusion of letters can occur that are of similar form. Insertion into the body of a text, marginal notes. Now, I'm going to show you some cases of this tonight in the illustrations. This right here is the Leningrad Codex B19A. It's sometimes called Leningradensis. It's a Ben Asher Hebrew Bible, which is a very precious Bible. It was dated to the year 1010. AD, it is the oldest complete Hebrew Bible in existence. What you have here, if you will look, you notice the little notations on the side margin? You notice these little notations? You notice these up here and these down here? The point is that oftentimes the scribes made such notations to inform later scribes about how they worked with the text and what's going on. And the problem is that sometimes some of those notations somehow or another got into the text over the course of time. Now, the marvel the study of ancient manuscripts is what we call the Dead Sea Scrolls. No doubt you've heard about them. The scrolls were discovered in 11 caves in the year 1947 and thereafter around the Wadi Qumran, which is a dry riverbed near the Dead Sea. About 100 scrolls are Old Testament books in the Hebrew language. All Old Testament books are found there except the book of Esther. And I have a hunch it was there, they just didn't find it. Maybe it was consumed by mice or insects or whatever, but there's no evidence of it. They all date from the last few centuries BC and the first century AD. Now, this is important because what I showed you a moment ago was the Ben Asher text, and that was from 1010 AD. Remember that? 1010 AD, the oldest complete manuscript of the Old Testament. These texts are 1,000 years older than that. And so what happened here is that study leapt 1,000 years backward. Now, what you would expect is to find out whether in that 1,000 years there were tremendous changes that took place. Well, translations of the Old Testament into Greek and Latin between AD 100 and 200 had already shown that the Hebrew had been copied very accurately, because you translate back, let's say from the Latin or the Greek. But the Masoretes had produced the Masoretic text as a unified text between the years 500 and 1,000, that produced ultimately this lovely text I just showed you a moment ago, the Ben Asher B19A text, which is the basis of the Stuttgartensia, which is the modern Hebrew text that is now utilized universally. It included cantillation accents. Have you ever heard in the synagogue as they sing, the cantor sings the text, which they do? Well, that's those sound, those vocalizations, marks are found in the text. The Dead Sea Scroll manuscripts provided no major alterations of the text. The scribes had done their work extremely well in 1,000 years. In fact, Dr. R. Laird Harris said on the Isaiah scroll copy, as he had worked with it, he said, it was so much like the Masoretic text from 1,000 years later that we must marvel at the accuracy of the scribes who worked in the succeeding centuries. Now, this is the area where they were discovered. You'll notice the cave openings here and here and in different areas around about. And the point is, it's in those caves where those caves, those scrolls were found. And this is the Qumran community there in the Wadi Qumran area. And then here is one of the scroll jars. Now, how did they live? How did they exist for nearly 2,000 and sometimes more than 2,000 years? How? Well, because they were preserved in these jars over that period of time, and it was a very dry desert climate. And as a result, unless the jars were broken, and you can see that this one, in fact, was broken. Notice the crack in it, that sometimes they turned into pieces instead of whole manuscript. This is one Qumran Habakkuk. You'll notice H-A-B, the Q means Qumran. This is the Habakkuk manuscript. And this is the second, this is what two means. It's the second Habakkuk manuscript. This is a absolutely gloriously beautiful manuscript. It is a Habakkuk manuscript. The book of Habakkuk is on there. It is Habakkuk 1 of Qumran, page 6. And if you'll notice, here is where the ancient scribe has made a fix. He's had to fix it, hasn't he? And that's the point. This is what we see in this kind of a manuscript. This is one of the most beautiful manuscripts you'll ever look at. You see, it is put together on a sewn piece, and it's absolutely glorious. Well, the point is, God has preserved the Old Testament scriptures in their essential purity. Among the extant manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible, there's extraordinary agreement. B. Kennicott, in his Vetus Testamentum Hebraicum, deals with variants from 600 different manuscripts. And aside from very insignificant ones, there's only one variant per 1,580 letters, and many of those are spelling differences that account for nothing. The variants, for the most part, are supported by only one or two manuscripts, and it's clear what the correct reading ought to be. And so Robert D. Wilson of Princeton wrote, and I quote him, in a scientific investigation of the Old Testament, page 69 of his book, there were hardly any variant readings in the manuscripts of the Old Testament Hebrew with the support of more than one out of the 200 to 400 manuscripts in which each book is found, except in the full and defective writing of vowels, a matter which has no bearing on either the pronunciation or the meaning of the text. We are scientifically certain that we have substantially the same text that was in the possession of Christ and the apostles at the time that Jesus used it. The LXX, or Septuagint version of the Old Testament from Hebrew, was produced in the 3rd to 2nd centuries BC. It is a Greek translation of the Old Testament. Jesus himself and his inspired New Testament writers frequently quoted from that Greek translation of the Old Testament, and they did so without any hesitation. In Matthew 22, 32, Jesus himself quotes Exodus chapter 3, verse 6 from the Septuagint manuscripts, and I'll note that he said, have you not read in Matthew 22, verse 31, have you not read that which was spoken to you by God? When he quoted a translation of the Bible. After 1,000 years of scribal transmission, Jesus still said that when the text was read, God was speaking. After a translation into a foreign language, Jesus still said that when the text was read, God was speaking. I think it's important for us to know that. Let's talk about the New Testament for a few minutes. The New Testament was written in Greek, as you might know. Books at first were copied in all capital letters. Later manuscripts from the 9th to the 16th century were in cursive. So the difference is one was the unsealed, the big, large or capital letters, and then the minuscule texts, which are in this cursive form. The abbreviations are sometimes occurring within the text. For example, the word God or Theos just appears as a theta, the first letter. The name Jesus, Jesus, is just very simply abbreviated. The name Lord, Kurios, is very simply abbreviated. Man, Anthropos, is abbreviated. Father, Pater, is abbreviated. Spirit, Pneuma, is abbreviated. And when you see those abbreviations, you always know them. It's a simple way of shortening the writing. At first, they copied these on what we call papyrus sheets, and that, of course, is made from a plant in Egypt, which was flattened and turned into a paper. From the 4th to the 13th centuries, however, parchment or vellum, an expensive method which lasted much longer and was very durable, the parchment manuscripts were utilized. Scrolls at first, then they were made into what we call a book or a codex. Now the codices are very important, because some of the finest manuscripts are codices. The earliest witness to the New Testament texts, however, are the so-called papyri. Over 70 of the papyri are known. P52 in the John Rylands Library in Manchester, England, is the oldest known New Testament document, dated to around 125 AD, four verses from the Gospel of John, chapter 18. All of the book of Acts, all of 1st and 2nd Peter, all of Jude, all of Luke, and all of John are found in papyri at very early dates. Here is one instance of that. This is a papyrus leaf from Paul's epistles. This is Hebrews chapter 1. And it's really quite easily read. Pros Hebraeus. To the Hebrews, it says. And then the text begins right here, just like it appears in a modern Greek Bible. Exactly the same. And that's from the year approximately 200 AD. Amazing. Here is P52, dated to 125. It's from the Gospel of John. 125 AD. Here from the John Rylands Library, papyrus fragment 457, John 18, verses 31 to 33, dated from 150 AD. This is the recto side. If you turn it over, here's the verso. The other side, this is John 18, 37 and 38, dated before 150 AD from the Gospel according to John. And here is the Gospel of John, chapter 1. And ladies and gentlemen, that is exactly what you would read in a Greek Bible today. Exactly what you would see in a Greek Bible today. And that is dated to about 200 AD. 100 years after the last apostle died or so. In arche kai hologos. In arche en hologos. Kai hologos en pros ton theon. It says. Kai Theos en hologos, and God was the Word. It says it right there. They believed it in the year 200. God was the Word. The uncial manuscripts, the most important, more than 250 uncial manuscripts are known, from small fragments to nearly complete Bibles, Old Testament and New Testament. They're copied with the greatest possible care by professional scribes. Therefore, they are the most important witnesses to the New Testament text. Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Beza, Codex Alexandrinus, and Codex Vaticanus, which is found in the Vatican Library, not surprisingly, all of them from the 4th to 5th centuries, are the four most famous. What they are is whole copies of the Bible. Remember what we said this morning when Diocletian said, I have stamped it out from the earth? No, he hadn't. The finest ones have come right down to us. And they are still there today. Here's a beautiful leaf from the Gospel of John. Again, in arche, en ho logos, kai ho logos en proston theon. There it is, right there, in this beautiful unsealed manuscript called Codex Sinaiticus, found in the Sinai Desert at a little oasis at the bottom of so-called Mount Sinai. Notice that what they did at the time, this is interesting, they read down this column up to here and then down here and then down and so forth. Beautifully, beautifully done. Then we see another unsealed manuscript. I wanted you to see this because I wanted you to see the little ekenoi. That word means that. And you'll notice that that is a correction. What it says here is ekenoi da. And these are additions because evidently a mistake was made somewhere in the process of the translating or the transmitting. And so the scribe made a mistake, so what did he do? He fixed it. There it is, it's fixed. And even though it doesn't make it as pretty as it would otherwise, and certainly the way we do it today is a whole lot easier with a computer, that's the best they could do. And you see their great care, how it mattered to them that the simple words ekenoi da appeared in the text as it originally did. Now, there are what we call cursive manuscripts, penned in longhand style. Most are on parchment. They date after the 9th century A.D. They number literally in the thousands, and they're of less value because of their late dates. 95% of all the manuscripts that we have are from this period, and this is one of them, and this says, Euangelion kata Lukon, the Gospel according to Luke. There it is, written in a cursive form of Greek. And so many of them, hundreds and hundreds and perhaps thousands and thousands of them. Well, then you have other evidences that forms things like lectionary scripture written for reading in church services and translations into Latin that we call versions and Syriac and Coptic and Armenian and all kinds of languages. And by translating backward into Greek then, scholars recreate the text that was originally in the hands of and used by that first translator. And then there are some patristic quotations that I might add are very important. Early church writers like, different guys that lived in the second century, like Justin Martyr, for example, is a good case. 150 A.D., he quoted from the Bible very often. And we know from 150 A.D. what he was reading from. It was his Bible, and that's important. Well, here is a Syriac manuscript here. Now, Syriac is a language that's still active. People still speak Syriac. And Syriac is obviously from Syria. And this is the Estrangela type of script that is used in Syriac. And what's interesting to note here is this is a translation into Syriac from the late 5th century of the New Testament. And notice, if you will, that this scholar, this scribe, made his notes in red ink. That's a little easier to decipher, isn't it? You can see he fixed it when there was a mistake or something like that in red ink rather than in the black that the rest of it is found in. But this is a beautiful piece. Here's another from Coptic, the Coptic language. Coptic is an Egyptian language, and the Coptic church today still uses this Coptic language Bible, and this is that script into which it was also translated. Well, the question is, are the New Testament documents reliable? Well, fortunately, here's a quotation. If the great number of manuscripts increases, this is from F.F. Bruce, by the way. He said, if the great number of manuscripts increases the number of scribal errors, it also increases proportionately the means of correcting all such errors, so that the margin of doubt left in the process of recovering the exact original wording is not so large as might be feared. It is in truth remarkably small. The variant readings about which any doubt remains among textual critics of the New Testament affect no material question. Let me say that again. Affect no material question of historic factor or of Christian faith or practice. Not one. There's not a single doctrine of the church that depends upon any text that has a question associated with it. And let me illustrate this. For example, the best attested ancient writing in the world is the Bible. For Caesar's Gallic War, composed in 58 to 50 BC, there are only 9 to 10 good manuscripts. The histories of Tacitus, who wrote in AD 100, depends upon only 2 manuscripts. The history of Thucydides, 460 to 400 BC, has 8 manuscripts from the 9th century AD, 1,300 years later. Herodotus' history has 8 manuscripts, all dated 1,350 years after he wrote it. Demosthenes has 7 manuscripts, all 1,300 years after its writing. And yet no one ever says that someone like Plato, whose great works depend upon 8 manuscripts from 1,300 years after his living in his time of writing. Would anyone doubt that we have their writings in essentially their original form? And yet, of the New Testament, there are over 5,366 manuscripts of the New Testament alone, and some of them, as I have shown you, are within 50 years of the date of writing. Within 50 years of the date of writing. Now, what's the real issue here? When disparagers like Briggs claim that we do not have the actual writings of the biblical writers, they are being neither reasonable nor scientific in their analysis. They're attempting to disparage the book, the Bible itself. They're trying to undermine the authority of the Bible. That's what they're really about, and that is the real issue here. And I want you to appreciate that. When it comes to subjects like that, that's the real problem. We're not talking about the fact that there's not enough evidence to know what the Bible teaches, or that our eyes can never be gladdened by reading the original. That's not what we're really talking about. What we're actually talking about is their lack of faith in what God said, and they just don't want to believe it. And frankly, I've seen down through the years a lot of people who went along with them for that ride because they don't want to believe it either. Because they don't want to listen to it. They don't want to obey it. And that's what it's really all about. So have confidence, Christian. No, the evidence is on your side, not on theirs. The real evidence is with you. You may not know how to say it precisely, but the evidence is on your side. And that's what I've been here this weekend to say to you. Is there someone tonight who would obey the gospel? Because you see, that's what it's all about. Because when I read my Bible, and I find that it tells me that I must hear, believe, repent, confess, and be baptized. Whether that matters or not has really to do with whether my heart is right with God, whether I'm really willing to submit my life and my heart to God and serve Him. And if I'm not, I might make all sorts of excuses. And one of those excuses might be, I just don't believe it's the original that I have. But when push comes to shove, any excuse will do, won't it? Don't let that happen to you. Come while we stand, while we sing. The voice of